Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Purim. This week, Neiman Novetzky discusses the Megillat Esther. Is it a secular or religious tale? Neiman Novetzky is a faculty member at Pardes. Her focus is Tanakh. And now, Neiman Novetzky.
With Purim coming up, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Megillah, and more specifically about the portraits of Esther and Mordechai that emerge from there. I think many of us grow up with an image of Mordechai and Esther as tzaddikim, as righteous Jews, spiritual leaders of the nation, observers of all 613 commandments, whose every action in the Megillah is motivated by religious concerns. The pshat, though, the simple reading of the Megillah, though, doesn't necessarily support such a portrait. Anyone reading the Megillah should be struck by the lack of explicit religious details. From the fact that the name of God is never mentioned, to the glaring absence of any mention of observance of mitzvot, or even prayers to God, despite the obvious need. The names of Mordechai and Esther suggest not righteous, but rather assimilated Jews. Mordechai comes from Marduk, the name of a Babylonian god. Esther is not much better. It recalls the Babylonian goddess Ishtar. So, is the Megillah a secular or a religious tale? Are Mordechai and Esther Jewish Persians or Persian Jews? And the rest of this shiur and the rest of this podcast, we will develop these two very different portraits of Mordechai and Esther, and ask how each approach would read certain key aspects, key questions that emerge from the Megillah. We will look into, first of all, the role of the party at the beginning of the Megillah. As all know, the Megillah opens with a description in the first chapter of a massive party that Ahasuerus holds for his entire country, for all the provinces. It lasts for about 6 months. One wonders, first of all, why does he make such a party? And second, why does the Megillah bother to tell us about it? Why does it waste, quote-unquote, an entire chapter to its description? A second question that I want to touch upon is the fact that Mordechai tells Esther to hide her identity, not to share where she come from, not to tell anybody that she's Jewish. Why does he tell her to do this? What's the purpose? And third, and perhaps the biggest question, why does Mordechai refuse to bow down to Haman? Many suggest that the answer is because it's prohibited, but that's not so simple. Throughout Tanakh, we see people bowing down to other humans. There does not seem to be any prohibition to bow down to another human. So what is it that makes Mordechai refuse? The answers to each of these three questions differs depending on how you read Mordechai and Esther. And each of the actions could be read as being motivated either by spiritual reasons or by political or personal ones. So let's go and develop the different portraits in answering these questions. We'll start with the more traditional approach to the Megillah, that adopted and developed by quite a few Midrashim and Mefarshim and commentators. That approach that sees in Esther and Mordechai good Jewish leaders who read the Megillah from beginning to end as a story all about religion. As we said, the story opens with a description of the party of Ahasuerus. Why does he make such a party? There are several different approaches to this question. One taken by Ibn Ezra reads, "Va'asa mishta, rabim amru ki asa mishta ba'avur shechashav kefi chashbono, v'ra'ah shelo yigalu Yisrael." Many say that why did Ahasuerus make this party? Because in his calculations, he saw that Bnei Yisrael were not going to be redeemed. He miscalculated the prophecy of 70 years and thought that the 70 years by which the Beit HaMikdash, by which the temple was supposed to have been rebuilt, had already passed. And he looks around and he sees the temple hasn't been built. Bnei Yisrael were not redeemed. And so he rejoices. And in his rejoice at the non-redemption of Bnei Yisrael, he decides to make a massive party. It's interesting, if one reads the chapter, one notices that there's actually a lot of language on the chapter that recalls language that is used in description of the Mikdash, of the temple, or the Mishkan. This is perhaps what leads the Midrash to suggest that not only was Ahasuerus partying over the fact that the temple wasn't rebuilt, but he was actually partying with the utensils of the temple, dressed in the clothes of the Kohen Gadol, as if to add insult to injury. Another reason for his making the party comes from the Midrash on Megillat Esther from Esther Rabbah. Amar Haman l'Achashverosh. Haman says to Achashverosh, Eloheim shel elu sonezima. Hamed lehem zonot, v'aseh lehem mishteh, u'gzar aleim sheyavou kulam v'yochlu v'yishtu v'yasu kirtonam. Haman tells Achashverosh that the God of Bnei Israel hates debauchery. So he says, go and invite prostitutes, make a huge party, and make a decree that all the Jews must attend. According to this approach, Haman provokes Ahasuerus into making the party. He suggests to Ahasuerus, make a party. Why? So as to get Bnei Israel. Invite them so that they'll be promiscuous, so that they'll eat and drink, and thus earn the wrath of God. The Midrash continues to tell us what was Mordechai's role in all of this. Kevan shera'a Mordechai kach, when Mordechai saw that thus was the intention of Haman, amad ve'chriz aleihem, he went and he decreed to all the Jews, lo telchu le'achol besuzato shel Achashverosh. Don't go and eat at the party of Achashverosh. Shelo hizmin etchem ki'im l'lamed aleichem kategoria, because his only reason for inviting you is to invite prosecution against you. So that there'll be an open mouth, there'll be reason for the kategor, for the prosecutor up in Shemayim, up in the sky, to go and argue against you before God. The point of these midrashim seems to be twofold. One, to explain why Bnei Israel deserved what happened to them in the Megillah. Why was there a decree of Haman to go and destroy all the Jews? The answer is the sins of Bnei Israel. They attended that party. They went and were promiscuous and ate and drank and did all sorts of horrible things at that party. And that's what earned them the wrath of God. But it's also coming to discredit Haman and Ahasuerus and to understand why they deserved what they got. In other words, what the Midrashim here, what the commentators are doing here in their explanations of the party, is framing our entire story as a story of sin and punishment. It's a story couched in religion. Similarly, we'll see with the explanation of why Esther decides to hide her identity. Rashi and the Pasuk, Lo higida Esther et moladeta. Esther did not tell from where she came, the name of her nation. Rashi says, Kedei sheyomru shehimi mishpacha bzuya v'yishalchuha. She'im yed'u shehimi mishpachat Sha'ul ha-melech hayu machzirim ba. He says, so that they'll say that she comes from a denigrated family, and they'll send her away. For had they known that she actually comes from the family of Sha'ul ha-melech, from the family of King Saul, they would for sure take her. Rashi says, what's the point in hiding Esther's identity? She did it so that she wouldn't be chosen as queen. Esther, coming from a line that can stretch its way all the way back to King Saul, comes from a dynastic family. She comes from Lucha, from kingship. And had that gotten back to the Persians, they would for sure rush to take her to the palace. In order to prevent herself from being taken, they hide her identity. The idea, of course, is that any good Jewish woman wouldn't want to be married to the non-Jewish Ahasuerus, and so she does all in her power not to. Rashi here seems to be picking up on a word in the beginning of the Megillah that describes Esther's being taken to the palace. The word is Vatilakach Esther. Esther was taken. Esther didn't go to the palace, but rather she was taken to the palace. It is a passive form. Against her will, she was taken. Many midrashim pick up on this idea, and they go into lengths of explaining how Mordechai tried to hide Esther so that no one would be able to find her. He puts her into a hiding place Unfortunately for her, though, in the end, she is found. But again, the point is to suggest, being a good Jew, Esther did everything in her power not to be chosen as queen. Another approach suggests something slightly different. Ibn Ezra reads, Hanachon be'enai, what is right in my eyes, ki asah zeh Mordechai ba'avur she'tishmor Torat Hashem b'seter. Mordechai suggested this so that she would be able to keep the Torah in secret. Shelo tochan nevelot v'tishmor shabbatot v'lo yagishu hamishartim kim yodeh hadavar shema hamelach yachirchena o yahargena. He says, she did all this so that she could keep mitzvot in secret. She wouldn't have to eat non-kosher. She'd be able to keep Shabbat, and no one would know the difference. Because had they known that she was a Jew, they would force her to not observe the commandments. Again, here comes an idea of a good religious Esther, keeping all Taryag mitzvot, not wanting anyone to know that she's Jewish, so that if she is chosen, she'll still be able to keep the mitzvot, since no one would know. Other midrashim support the same idea on the words that Esther had sheva ne'arot, that she had seven maidservants. They explain, Esther did this so that they wouldn't know that she's keeping Shabbat. There was one for every day of the week. Thus, no one would know that she acted differently on the seventh day on Shabbat. Similarly, they suggest, when Esther is told of Haman's decree, we realize that Esther actually hadn't known about it until Mordechai tells her. And we wonder, how is it that she didn't know? So the Midrash answers, this is around the time of Pesach. Esther was so busy cleaning up for Pesach and preparing for Pesach that she hadn't paid attention to what was going on outside. Again, a portrait of Esther and Mordechai as keeping all the mitzvot, doing all that they can to be good Jews despite what's going on around them. When we move into our last question, that about why Mordechai refused to bow down to Haman, again, we see the same line of thinking. In the Midrash on Esther and Esther Rabbah, they tell us why it is that Mordechai refused. And they write, Kishetziva Achashverosh lishtachavot lehaman, when Achashverosh said that all must bow to Haman, chakak avodat kochavim alibo, he engraved an image of idolatry on his heart. V'nitkavin kadesh yishtachavu lavodat kochavim. And he meant that everyone should bow down to this idolatry. Of course, if this is the case, that Haman made a pesel on his clothing, he made an idol on his clothing, the refusal of Mordechai is a religious refusal. Of course, as is Haman's desire for him to bow down. Both are motivated by religious or spiritual concerns. We have a similar midrash or similar explanation brought in Rashi. He says, Kor'imu mishtachavim sha'asah atzmo aloha, that Haman made himself into a god. Here we have a slight difference. It's not that he was wearing some image of idolatry, but that since Haman himself thought of himself as a god, Mordechai refused to bow down. It would be bowing down to idolatry. Amos Chacham in the excerpt called Dat Mikra, which is an explanation on all 24 books of Tanakh, points out that the combination of the two words kriya v'hishtachavaya, bending your knees and bowing down, when we use both those terms in Tanakh, it actually doesn't refer in Tanakh to bowing down to a person, but rather is unique in the Mikra to bowing down to either Hashem or to Avodah Zarah. So this would support an otherwise unbased midrash that Haman actually had a picture of Avodah Zarah on his clothing. So to summarize what we've seen until now, those that read the story as a religious one see a story which is totally framed in sin and punishment. It starts off with describing the sin of the nation and the sin of Haman and Achashverosh, and ends with punishment first for the people and then their salvation, which becomes punishment for the others. Mordechai and Haman are fighting over spiritual matters. Esther hides her identity out of religious concerns. The book from beginning to end is all about religion. Let's now move, though, to our second portrait, the read that suggests that Mordechai and Esther aren't good Jews, but rather assimilated ones. So how does this approach read the party at the beginning? Why does Ahasuerus make a party at the beginning? Here, the suggestion is that Ahasuerus makes a party not for religious reasons, but rather for political ones. Dat Mikra suggests, Mistaber sheshtei hashanim harishonot hayu shanot mehumot umeridot, v'rak bashana hashlishit nitzeach hatamordim, v'yashav al kisei machalto, umishum kach asa mishteh gadol. Dat Mikra suggests that perhaps the first 2 years of Ahasuerus's reign had been filled with rebellions and with confusions and things that weren't peaceful. Only by the time he gets to his third year, the point at which our story starts, is he able to be victorious over those rebels, and thus he makes a party to establish his kingship. Interestingly, Yaron Chazoni, in a book called The Dawn, which is a political read of the story of Megillat Esther, suggests the exact opposite, that perhaps Ahasuerus is hiding defeats and thus distracting the nation by making a party. Either way, of course, the party has nothing to do with sin and punishment. There's no Mordechai pleading with the Jews not to intend, for the party has nothing to do with religion at all. And in fact, it's very likely that Mordechai, along with the rest of the Jews, joined in that party and was happy to attend like everyone else. Why does Mordechai tell Esther to hide her identity? Here we get the exact opposite approach from that which Rashi had suggested earlier. She hides her identity so that she will have a chance of being chosen to be queen. Esther, if she's an assimilated Jewess, is like everyone else, and perhaps was excited at the prospect of becoming queen. What honor, what prestige! Rav Meidan, in an article on our topic, suggests that the two, Mordechai and Esther, assimilated Jews, are in fact ashamed of their Jewishness. And that's why they hide it. They don't want everyone to pick up on the fact that they're different from everyone else. They're living in Persia, and they want to be like the Persians around them. A different approach, which is perhaps a little less harsh to Mordechai and Esther, suggests that yes, they did want to be chosen, and in order to be chosen, they did want to hide their identity, thinking that it won't help them to share the fact that they're Jewish. But not for honor and prestige, but rather so that they could save the Jews. This is a portrait of a political Mordechai and Esther, who, yes, might not be totally observant, are for sure perhaps not totally righteous, but are still proud of their Jewishness. And they weigh the different factors and say, let's hide our Jewishness. Let's compromise a little bit in that area. But why? So that we can move into a position in which we might save the Jewish people. Chazoni points out in his book, The Dawn, that we mentioned beforehand, that the verses say that Mordechai was Yoshev Bishar HaMelech. He sat in the king's gates. From the usage of this term in Tanakh, we know that one who sat in the king's gates didn't happen to just be strolling by, but rather was someone who was in the government. Basically, someone who would have sat in the parliament. Mordechai had made his way up in Persian society, had climbed the rungs of those ladders to get to his political position, and now he was paving the way for Esther to do the same. And sometimes that means compromising. That means not sharing who you are. But here, with the hopes that it'll put them into the best possible position to help their fellow Jews. So why doesn't Mordechai bow down? Again, if we take the assimilated and secular Esther and Mordechai approach, the answer is that Mordechai doesn't bow down because of his own personal honor. If Mordechai has been an important officer in the king's palace for quite some time, he's just saved the king's life. If we remember the story of Bigtan and Teresh, Mordechai has gone and told the king, save the king's life, and perhaps he expects a reward. Yet, he gets nothing. And instead, in the very next verses, what do we read? That it's Haman who is picked to be second in command. Presumably, Mordechai is just a bit jealous, and so, perhaps, he refuses to bow down. Perhaps he uses the explanation that he is a Jew, not because he's really not bowing down due to his Jewishness, but rather because he can't quite disobey the king's orders so explicitly, and thus leads others to think that the reason is religious. There are actually some hints to this negative portrayal of Mordechai in some midrashim. There's a midrash that refers to the fact that Mordechai is referred to as both a Yehudi and a Yemini, as a Jew, or perhaps one might have thought someone that comes from Yehuda, and a Yemini, someone who comes from Shevet Binyamin. So they say, Ma'asali Yehudi, delo katlei David lishim'i, de'ityaleid minei Mordechai, de'miknei be'haman. They said, why is he called a Yehudi? In order to refer us back to a previous Yehudi, to David, who hadn't killed Shimi, from whom Mordechai was born. At one point, there was a person named Shimi who had cursed David. David had the chance to kill him and decided not to. Here, the Gemara is actually saying that that was a negative thing. He shouldn't have killed Shimi. Why? Because from Shimi came Mordechai. We say, what do you mean, from Shimi came Mordechai? That's a good thing. But no, according to this approach, there's actually something negative about Mordechai. If Mordechai, due to his own personal honor, refused to bow down to Haman, then it's Mordechai's fault that all of the Jews were put into danger in the story of the Megillah. And so here, the Gemara actually is upset at Mordechai. There's another interesting midrash that also plays against Mordechai and Haman, suggesting that there's some background to our story. They suggest that the two of them knew each other way before the story of the Megillah, and both of them were put onto some official envoy, where they were supposed to travel by sea to the king. Both of them are on that boat, and we see that they both take some food to go, and they leave. So the Agadah continues, Hayam Mordechai ha-tzadik ochel pito ma'at ma'at. Mordechai the tzadik ate his bread a little at a time. V'haman ha-rasha lo hishkiach ad shechaser mizono. Haman, though, wasn't paying attention. He didn't think ahead to think, oh, maybe this journey is going to take 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And he finished all his food very at the beginning. So he comes to Mordechai and he begs him, please loan me a loaf of bread. Mordechai says to him, if I give you, will you sell yourself to me? Amarlo Cain, he agrees. Miad katav Haman al sandalo shel Mordechai. Immediately Haman wrote on the sandal of Mordechai, Ani Haman ha'agagi avdo shel Mordechai. I, Haman ha'agagi, am the servant of Mordechai. Shenimkarti lo ba'ad kikar lacham. I sold myself to him for a loaf of bread. Ukshaya Mordechai yoshev b'shar ha'melech. So when Mordechai sat at the king's gates, v'ro'et Haman over, whenever he would see Haman pass, he would show his foot on which the contract of his selling of himself to Mordechai was written. This Agadah, of course, is not found in the Megillah. There's no hint to such a thing happening. But I think it raises a very interesting possibility to the idea that Mordechai and Haman should be seen as rivals. Their interaction in the story is perhaps an interaction of personal confrontation, each jealous of the other, each trying to outdo the other, each trying to climb up that ladder in Persian society, and each one getting upset when the other surpasses him. It's actually interesting because if you look at the entire story of the Megillah, it's constantly setting up Mordechai versus Haman. Mordechai Sabato, in an article in a book called Hadassah Hiester, points out how the whole book revolves around their interactions. The entire idea of v'nahafochu, that there is reversals, revolves around not just the status of Am Yisrael, but their status vis-a-vis one another. As one goes up, the other goes down, with, of course, the riding on the horse as being the turning point. So again, it seems that there is one way of reading the Megillah as being all about an assimilated Mordechai and Esther out to promote themselves, thinking about themselves perhaps at the expense of Am Yisrael. If so, though, one wonders, well, what's so special about Mordechai and Esther? Why do they save Am Yisrael in the middle of the story? If this whole tale is a secular tale with no mention of mitzvot, no tefillah, because no one's observing any mitzvot, no one's praying anything to God. If it's a story about our two leaders who are so self-absorbed that they actually endanger the rest of society. So what's so special? What's so unique? Why do we laud Mordechai and Esther? So here too, Rav Meidan, in the article that I had referred to before, suggests something interesting. He says, "Bikisha zo, if one takes this approach, in behechreach tam lifgam biishiyuto shel Mordechai, one doesn't have to necessarily read it as a negative, as a flaw in the character of Mordechai. Why not? Vizot, kevan shekol adam nidon al shem sofo, because every man should be judged by his end. V'machein haya Mordechai mekachesh lihudato, o adishla, and if Mordechai had actually denied his Judaism or was indifferent to it, v'kach ala l'gdula, and that's how he had risen to power. V'sham, areka ishi, histabech ba'atzmo, v'sibecha kol Am Yisrael ba'ashmato, b'tzara gdula, and if there, due to his personal interactions with Haman, due to his personal background, he complicated himself, he complicated the entire Am Yisrael. Hare ye amer l'shchuto, what we need to say to his merit, is sheberega hagorali, at the momentous moment, when it really counted, lo hitchakesh la'achrayuto l'masha olel. He didn't deny responsibility. V'natal et ma'aseot la'achrayuto shelo, v'asad kol sheyachol la'asot kedoy lahotzi et avo mitzara. And he took the responsibility to do whatever there was in his power to get his nation out of distress. V'yachad im Esther v'im kol Yehudei Shushan, and together with Esther and the rest of the Jews of Shushan, shav, he returned. Lo rak elamo, not just to his nation, ki imgam el Elohav, but also to his God. If one takes this approach, one must pay attention to the fact that it's not from beginning to end, perhaps, that Mordechai and Esther are that assimilated secular Jew, but rather that there's a turning point in the middle of the story. When Mordechai and Esther realize that they are part of this nation, that they can no longer hide their identities, that they must help their nation and identify themselves with the nation and become one with them. And the fact that they do so is perhaps what the story is all about. Someone pointed out to me that it's interesting that one of the special mitzvot of Purim is mishloach manot and matanot lavyonim, giving gifts to each other and giving gifts to the poor. Mitzvot that are somewhat unique to this holiday. Reading the Megillah, we understand, but why especially these mitzvot? So they answered that these mitzvot are mitzvot that make you think about the other, that make you identify with the Jews around you. And if that's perhaps part of what was Esther and Mordechai's lesson in the Megillah, then it's a very appropriate mitzvah to have on this day. So just to sum up, there are many different ways to read the Megillah, different portraits of Mordechai and Esther. One could read them as good, firm Jews, frame the entire story in mitzvot, in sin and punishment, in people trying to be good and care about their others. Or one could read this as a story of an assimilated, secular Mordechai and Esther, who travel together with the nation towards God. With those thoughts, I wish you a Purim Sameach.
Thank you, Naima. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send your comments to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in. Purim Sameach, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.